ever feel it? When people get unkind, you can hear their voices. They got poison on their mind. Though ignorance can never be excused, I'll do my best to shake off their attitudes. I'm walking away again, but there's one thing that will make me take a stand. If my brother's in trouble, I will always help him out. If my brother's in trouble, I will turn the world around. I will fight for his right. I'll be there no matter where his trouble lies. Young men are walking blind, but if the heat comes down, I'll be standing by your side. I am there for him like he is there for me. Nothing feels as good as a brother's loyalty. Talking about family, talking about what my brother means to me. If my brother's in trouble, I will always help him out. Brothers in trouble, I will turn the world around. I will fight for his right. I'll be there no matter where his troubles lie. If my brother's in trouble, so am I. If my brother's in trouble, so am I. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'll be right there to help you. Just reach out your hand, I'll pull you through.
Hello, brothers and sisters. This is Gerald here. And what we want to talk about now is the Standing Rock situation. Standing for what's right. Shouldn't be that complicated. For more than 4 months, members of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in North Dakota have mobilized to block the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. In the past month, members of more than 200 tribes and bands from across North America have joined them. More than 3,000 Native Americans and their supporters have joined the camp at Sacred Stone Camp to oppose the pipeline. This 1,200-mile-long pipeline could carry 570,000 barrels of thick crude oil per day from the Bakken oil fields to southern Canada, and northern North Dakota and Montana into Illinois. Aside from the threat of oil spills into the rivers and underground fresh water aquifers. This pipeline poses a threat to life on Earth. Refining and burning of this oil is the equivalent of pouring poison into our air and water. This is the sort of project scientists have been warning us about for decades. Putting more carbon into the atmosphere will drastically change the Earth's climate. What were once warning signs have now become a dangerous reality. Scientists warned that if global carbon dioxide content in the atmosphere rose above 350 ppm, that is parts per million, the Earth's temperature would rise significantly. It is now consistently over 400 ppm. The last time there was this much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was over 15 to 20 million years ago. It was 5 to 11 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than now. Because of the melting of the Earth's ice sheets at that time, sea levels were between 75 and 125 feet higher than they are today. The environment our ancestors evolved in did not yet exist. And we got to understand, our cities, we have coastal cities that are not designed for the water to go up 100 feet. Some people think it's real cool to be right there on the edge. If the water goes up 125 feet, what would that mean? Think about it. The flooding that would ensue. Those in power have been driven by the greed of the profits derived from oil. Our new normal is that each month is hotter than the year before. July 2016 was the 15th consecutive warmest month since records began being kept in 1880. Within the next 2 years, Arctic ice is expected to totally disappear during the summer. In India, more than one-fourth of the land is being turned into desert. This year, the Great Barrier Reef off of the coast of Australia had a massive coral bleaching event that killed off more than one-fifth of the reef. The new climate reality is here and having a devastating impact in the poorest, most vulnerable parts of the world. And that is why the mobilization at Standing Rock is so important. Those in power use their police and private guards, attack dogs that I haven't seen in decades used against demonstrators, and pepper spray against the water defenders. Nearly 70 people have been arrested, some charged with felonies for blocking the operation of equipment. The fight to defend the Earth is one of life and death. It don't take more degrees than a thermometer to figure that out. The question facing us all is what to do. The Standing Rock Sioux have taken a stand. Agencies of the federal government have pretended to show concern, calling for more studies. Their courts have responded, halting the construction for a moment, then giving the go-ahead, then stopping again. The legal focus is on one portion of the pipeline, while construction goes on everywhere else. The legalities involved are irrelevant. This is people's water. This is our earth. We cannot be held back by this system, a system that at one time legalized the genocide of native peoples, the slavery of Africans, and continues with the exploitation of workers and the environment. The people of Standing Rock are right to stand up to protect the land they live on, the water they depend on, and finally, to keep the oil in the ground. Their fight, actually, is our fight. So if you want to make a donation to help these people, you can go to standingrock.org. By the way, I just want to mention, I went to a forum last night in San Francisco, at the Party of Socialism and Liberation's offices, and Mr. Dennis Banks spoke. Dennis Banks is a historic leader of the Native American people through an organization called the American Indian Movement. And it was quite moving, actually, to listen to him explain the whole struggle in Wounded Knee that he participated in. He was arrested, and they tried to make him a political prisoner, but he won his case. Unfortunately, Leonard Peltier did not, and he is still in prison. Free him now. That brother needs to be free. But what we're going to do now is we're going to play a little tape of Dennis Banks speaking, so to reintroduce him to the public. Here we go, guys.
This is Dennis Banks on the Block Report.
With the Minister of Information, JR of the POCC. Mr. Banks, can you tell us, why did you guys start the American Indian Movement, and why was it relevant to Native people's lives when it did start?
And the reason why we started is because of the rampant racism and discrimination shown against us. Actually, it was being shown against everybody in the 60s, 50s, 40s, whenever. But we decided that we would have to organize, and we did that to fight the discrimination in housing, employment, and in the schools where they were, our kids were being pushed out of schools. So that was these enforcement of treaty rights in Minnesota, which is very close to, we have hunting and fishing, we do trapping, and we have lakes up there that we govern. And so the state of Minnesota was trying to encroach on these rights, trying to get authority and jurisdiction over them. So that was the main reason why we fought, because why we stood up and formed the American Indian Movement in July of 1968.
Now, there's been a lot of talk about how the federal government moved against organizations like the American Indian Movement and the Black Panther Party. Can you speak specifically, how did COINTELPRO hit AIM, and how did the FBI and CIA and all the other policing agencies dismantle AIM in terms of their attacks?
I'm glad you asked that this time, because, you know, with Bush's spying on domestic spying that's going on, actually international spying, but the spying on local people, citizens, is reminiscent of Nixon and the Hoover's COINTELPRO program, which was counterintelligence programs. They tried to disrupt the American Indian Movement. They infiltrated our defense committees with informants and operatives. Doug Durham was probably, the visible one who he became my chief of staff, but he was an informant for the operative, rather, for the FBI and the CIA. So they were disruptive. They were trying to get us involved with conspiracies. The informants were always trying to edge us on into getting fights with law enforcement. They were trying to provoke and promote, violence between the American Indian Movement and other people.
So how, when you say they were trying to provoke it, was it like brown letter jobs, or what were some of the tactics?
Well, the informants, in this particular case, it was the operative for the FBI and the CIA, Doug Durham, who would engage me in conversation. He would say, "Dennis, we should go bomb these guys. Just give me the word, and I'll pick up the bomb and I'll go bomb these guys, or I'll assassinate these people." He was always trying to engage me in conversation like that. At one time, he even brought me a bomb. He says, "Give me the place, tell me where I should go put it." He says, "I'll go do it." So it was that kind of not only infiltration, but that kind of trying to provoke us, so that the police would come down hard on us.
Can you speak to the relationship that the American Indian Movement had with the Black Panther Party?
Oh, that was a good relationship that we had in the beginning. Still, to this day, David Hilliard is a great friend of mine, and I consider him to be, in the beginning, out there and by himself. Well, I guess all of us, in many ways, were out there by ourselves. But it came, David and Huey Newton and the rest of the Panther Party officials stood up at a time when America was at its probably its most treacherous, hateful time of beating and killing Native people, Black people, Latinos. You know, they're going against the war. It was bad, but the bad feelings, reputation that the FBI gained, you know, was cause of men like the Black Panthers and the American Indian Movement standing up and standing together. And I didn't know how far the government would go to try and crush our movement until we were surrounded at Wounded Knee with 35 armored personnel carriers and 300 FBI agents and 90 U.S. Marshals. Then I knew that they were very serious in trying to crush us.
What is the last thing you want to say to youth of color that are trying to make a difference today?
Well, first of all, we can never abandon our ancestry. We can never abandon our heritage. We always have to have that with us. And, you know, if we don't know our heritage, if we don't know our ancestry, then we've got to remain true to our own convictions. We've got to, you know, we've got to rally around our community. We've got to, you know, protect the future. What are the future generations? What is our future? And I think that's what we got to fight for and protect. You know, if we can't fight for the past, then we've got to fight for the future.
You were just listening to the voice of Dennis Banks, co-founder of the American Indian Movement, with your host, Minister of Information, J.R. of the POCC. If you would like to get in touch with the Block Report, you can email us at blockreportradio@yahoo.com.
All right, we're back. And so I wanted to add a little bit to Gerald's discussion of the Standing Rock protests, because these struggles that we're bringing up on the show, that we're seeing in the news, that we're hopefully engaged with in some way, are not unrelated to one another. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what's happened in terms of police violence this week. But before I do that, I want to try and draw some connections between all of these struggles, but particularly between what's happening at Standing Rock and what's happening in the prisons. Now, indigenous people are victimized by the police and the prison system in a number of different ways that's much higher than the average population. So I have a few facts here. This is from an Earth First article that is very well researched. Native Americans are incarcerated at a rate 38% higher than the national average. This is according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics. Indigenous youth are 30% more likely than whites to be referred to juvenile court, than have charges dropped, according to the National Council on Crime and Delinquency. Native Americans are more likely to be killed by police than any other racial group, according to the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. Native American men are incarcerated at 4 times the rate of white men. Native American women are incarcerated at 6 times the rate of white women. According to a report compiled by the Lakota People's Law Project. Finally, Native Americans fall victim to violent crime at more than double the rate of all other U.S. citizens, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics report. 88% of violent crime committed against Native American women is carried out by non-Native perpetrators. So the history of land struggle is connected to the history of prison struggle. This is another quote from the article. Today in the 21st century, the language of manifest destiny, you know what manifest destiny is? The belief that the colonists had, that that it is the divine right of these European settlers to stretch their takeover from coast to coast. So the language of manifest destiny has been rebranded as, quote, job creation. Just as politicians tell us that prison jobs rehabilitate prisoners, they tell us that constructing the Dakota Access Pipeline is helping the economy. And in Kentucky, a federal prison will alleviate unemployment in the Appalachian coalfields. But we know better. pipelines are the extension of genocide. Prisons are the extension of slavery. So I'd like us to just think about that a little bit and let that settle on us. And maybe we'll talk about it more in the coming weeks, how these struggles connect with one another, how these common currents run through the history of oppression and through the history of resistance. Now, turning to... one more. So turning to what's happened this week in the world of the police, 8 people were killed by the police this week. I'm going to try and make it a habit of when I come in here to sort of remind us of that all too high number from week to week. One police murder that's caught some attention this week is the murder of Alfred Olongo, a Ugandan refugee who was having a mental health episode, and his sister called 911 to try and get some help. The police arrived and killed him. The video exists but hasn't yet been released. The police are sort of using still frames of the video to try and sort of manipulate the public opinion.
I just wanted to share this point that to define what Eric is talking about still frames. This gentleman was mentally ill. His sister called 911 and was asking for assistance to help this gentleman who was going through a mental crisis. At this point, what's supposed to happen, civilized people do not kill mentally ill people because they're mentally ill. So this gentleman actually took a stance like he was firing a weapon. Check this out. And he had a cigarette, an e-cigarette in his hands. You would think that an officer of the law should know what a gun looks like. And they should have understood that they're going to deal with somebody that is in a mental crisis. Totally. And by the way, I do have to add this. They actually had a mental crisis team that they did not send to help. They sent the police, and the police did what they do.
That's right. Does an e-cigarette look like a gun? What do you all think? It absolutely does not. And so pay attention. This happened to the south of us in El Cajon, California, near San Diego. Protests erupted later in the week in response to this murder. So the media has been real quiet about it, so I encourage you to keep your eyes peeled. It's important when the police murder people that we show up, that we respond. So now we're going to hear some words from Mumia Abu-Jamal on police violence and repression.
A woman working to feed the homeless gets involved in a confrontation with transit cops down in a major metropolitan subway. She's accosted, manhandled, thrown to the ground, and held under restraint. Another woman has her window shattered by highway patrol when she doesn't move her car fast enough nor open her window on command. She is seized, handcuffed, and arrested. What makes these cases remarkable is the identity of the women described here. The first, in addition to being a political leader in her own right, is the wife of a United States congressman. The second, a prominent professional, is the wife of a Pennsylvania state representative. Both women are African American. Although charges were later dropped against these women, the very fact that they were treated so crudely, despite their prominence and influence, makes one wonder about how cruelly people without such influence are treated by agents of the state. The two events just described actually occurred in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in 1993. The first involving Philadelphia City Councilwoman Mrs. Janie Blackwell, the wife of freshman United States Democratic Representative Lucian Blackwell. The second involved a leading Philadelphia black lawyer, Mrs. Renee Hughes, past president of the prestigious Barristers Association, local affiliate of the National Bar Association, and wife of State Representative Vincent Hughes of the 170th District. That both cases were administratively resolved is of less importance than the fact the incidents occurred at all. Such incidents are but daily occurrences in the lives of black men and women in America, regardless of class, rank, status, or station in life. That cops can treat people so shabbily, indeed, the very people who literally pay their salaries and set their operating budgets, gives a grim glimmer of life at the social, economic, political bottom, where people have no influence, no clout, no voice. These cases reveal the cold contempt held by white cops for black men and women, even if those women are in positions of state power which are presumed to be in control. In truth, any control is illusory and as totally effervescent as power itself. Police are out of control. Black politicians are out of power. When these events occur, we can only conclude that if such events can happen to them, what of us? If people can watch the massacre of MOVE people on May 13, 1985, as police firebomb MOVE headquarters, the ATF-FBI ramming and destruction of the Corinthians of Waco, Texas in April 1993, and still claim the police are under control, then nothing said here will convince them. The police are agents of white ruling class capitalist will, period. Neither black managers nor black politicians can change that reality. The people themselves must organize for their own defense, or it won't get done. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
All right. And so it's not only the police that are out of control, it is also prison officials and guards, as we've seen. I have one last report that I want to share about state repression and violence that's taking place always all over the world. This is a first-person account of an anarchist prisoner named Jennifer Gahn, who is a trans woman incarcerated in Kern County, close to home for me. These are her words. I'm currently sitting in a cold gray cement cell with nothing but a sink, toilet, bunk, and basic necessities. I was on D facility Tuesday afternoon. That's September 13th, just a couple of weeks ago. Going out to the yard for my housing unit when I heard a CO behind me begin yelling at and harassing one of my sisters. So I stopped to see what the problem was, when several COs immediately turned around toward me and began yelling, "Turn around and get down." As soon as I turned my back to comply, I was assaulted from behind, by my face slammed forward into a metal locker, splitting my head wide open, blood gushing as four or five guards began punching and kicking me as I lay face down, unable to move. They had me pinned down, knees in my back and on my head. They kept yelling, "Stop resisting." We've heard that one, haven't we? Once the handcuffs were on, they picked me up, escorted me across the yard in front of a couple dozen inmates as I yelled, "F the police." They slammed me to the ground a couple more times, put all their weight on me so I couldn't breathe. Visions of Eric Garner passed through my mind. I was kept in a holding cage for 4 hours with no medical care, bleeding. My face is black and blue. Later that evening, I was taken to Delano Regional Medical Center, where I sat in the ER for 5 hours, got stitches and x-rays, and a CT scan. Now I'm sitting in the hole on a bogus charge of threatening staff. So Jennifer is facing some serious repression as a result of her coming to the aid of one of her comrades. If you wanted to write Jennifer, you can write J Gahn, G-A-N-N, number E 2385-2, at Kern Valley State Prison, P.O. Box 5107, Delano, California, 93216. That's if you want to send Jennifer Gahn your love. Now I'm going to give it back to Gerald. Gerald's going to talk to us about some upcoming events and the upcoming election cycle that we're all aware of.
Okay, well, Slave Revolt Radio doesn't endorse any candidates per se. That's not our job. But we do have an election coming up, and in this state, there is not only people running for office, but also there is a series of propositions that I think, whether or not you like elections, if they asked you, can we continue to execute people and kill people, we might want to say no to something like that. So for those of you who do pay attention to what's going on with the elections, this is really for you. For those who, everyone should pay some attention, particularly to the propositions. Just recently, I was a speaker on a panel about making sense of the 12 local measures and 17 state propositions. So, in other words, a measure is something that they passed for a city. The proposition is statewide. Okay? You should just notice that there has been an increase in citizen participation in elections recently. So this year they have something they call the Berkeley Progressive Alliance. They are trying to pattern themselves after the Richmond Progressive Alliance, I believe. So the Berkeley Progressive Alliance works at the local level to address the challenges of global climate change and growing economic inequality. On a local level, let's see what they can accomplish. We stand for open, transparent, and fair governance, social and economic justice, and an inclusive, diverse city. We support candidates for Berkeley mayor and city council who will support our progressive agenda and be held accountable. Well, that sounds good. So here they are. For mayor, they got this guy, Jesse Aragon. For District 2, Nancy Armstrong Temple, who was in Black Lives Matter. Ben Bartlett. So for District 3, District 5 is Sophie Hahn. And District 6 is Fred Dosworth the third. But more important from my perspective, I think, is the rent board election, because there is a little bit of a renaissance in terms of tenants organizing to defend their interests. And that is the crazy runaway high rents that come along with gentrification. Look, in the city of Berkeley, there were 25% of the population was black. Today, that is roughly 10%. So their a progressive agenda is affordable housing, because shelter is a human right. A green, sustainable city meeting standards for increased building, transportation, and infrastructure. Social and racial justice, that is fair treatment for all. Economic justice and economic vitality. Better public education, closing the achievement gap and improving education of all our children. Campaign finance reform. Get the money out of politics. Let's make democracy work. That's what they're saying. For 2006, the Alameda County Affordable Housing Bond looks interesting. Here are some of the facts. This measure will raise $580 million for affordable housing across Alameda County. All funds from the proposed bond must stay local, dedicated to affordable housing needs in Alameda County only. This measure includes independent annual audits to ensure funds are spent as approved by voters. Because the politicians be putting everything in the general fund, and then the money gone. The cost of property owners is projected to be $12 to $14 per $100,000 of assessed value of their homes. Not to be confused with the market value. The assessed value of a property is often much lower than its market value. The typical Alameda County homeowner would pay $48 to $56 per year, or less than $5 per month, to support this critical initiative, so they say. Okay. Rental Housing Development Program, regional funding allocation throughout Alameda County. Half of funds to regional pools. So, you know, this gets into this whole question of vouchers for people to live. A lot of, there's quite a bit to look at here. Now, this measure, let's see, the Affordable Housing Bond, that's what it's called. I'm looking to see the rental housing program, Rental Housing Development Fund. The goal of it is to create and preserve affordable rental housing for vulnerable populations, including lower income workforce housing. Developments will remain affordable over the long term, estimated to be for at least 55 years. That would be reasonable if it could happen. Let's see. So this measure, an affordable housing bond, is on the November ballot. Please find out more about it, because to be honest with you, I don't know. I'm just trying to share as much of this information as I can with you. Now, a little bit about the pro-tenant slate that is running for the Berkeley Rent Board. They are Christina Murphy, Alejandro Soto Vigil, and Laith Simon Weisberg, and Igor Trego. Those are the people. And here is their program. They say, help us protect the Berkeley we love, support our seniors, support our working families, support our disabled, differently abled communities, support our low-wage workers, artists, and others. They say they have a track record, so that I'm going to share with you. A combined 50 years of experience fighting for tenants' rights and the Berkeley we can all call home. These people participated in local, regional, and statewide efforts to strengthen eviction protections and expand the supply of and the financing of for lower-income housing for working families. These people funded eviction defense programs and nonprofit housing while balancing the rent board budget. And they worked on broad coalitions to stop measures that would have criminalized homelessness. So this is interesting. They want to defend rent control, as I stated before, strengthen tenant protections, fight tenant harassment, oppose unlawful evictions, ensure habitability, and expand rent board services. So if you live in Berkeley, you got a rent board. What kind of rent board do you want? That's really the question. These people apparently have the unions behind them. Alameda County Labor Council, the Berkeley Tenants Union, the Alameda County Green Party have endorsed them. The SEIU, Service Employees International Union, Local 1021, supports them. The United Food and Commercial Workers support them. The Amalgamated Transit Union, Local 192, that's the BART workers, support them. So here you go. That's an alternative. Please, I'll say again, find out more about it. I'm just trying to share some of the important, you know, matters that we all need to be aware of. Now, first of all, there are oh, I don't know, maybe more than 50 propositions on the ballot. I can't possibly cover all of those. But what I will do is try to touch on some of the more important ones. Proposition 51. This is, by the way, the recommendations of the Peace and Freedom Party that I'm reading to you now. See, the Peace and Freedom Party opposes the $9 billion school bond, with the $1 billion going to charter school construction. I'm personally opposed to charter schools. This money must be repaid with an additional $8.6 billion in tax-free interest. So the Peace and Freedom Party says that you should vote no on Proposition 51. Proposition 52 secures funding for Medi-Cal and services for poor people from a hospital fee, and prevents the state legislature from diverting the earmarked money to the general fund. They recommend you vote yes on Proposition 52. Proposition 53 requires an undemocratic supermajority to vote to approve revenue bonds financed by the proceeds from the funded projects. Peace and Freedom Party recommends a no on that. Proposition 54 looks like a Republican answer to a dispute between two major parties about how to make legislative processes more transparent. So I think you're going to have to read that one. I don't really understand it at this point to take a position on it, and the Peace and Freedom Party says they're sitting it out. Proposition 55 extends Proposition 30, which taxes the wealthy to increase funding for education and health care. Proposition 55 lets the 1/2 cent sales tax in Proposition 30 expire at the end of 2016. And the Peace and Freedom Party recommends you vote yes, tax the rich. Proposition 56 adds a $2 a pack excise tax on cigarettes and raises taxes on e-cigarettes. This regressive tax will hurt low-income people. The poor pay more. How long? No. Vote no on jacking the price of cigarettes. I went to New York and I went to get a pack of cigarettes. Guess how much a pack of cigarettes was? Check this out. Eric, how much you think they was charging for a pack of cigarettes? $12. Hey! Come on now. Come on now. Vote no on Proposition 56. They're helping again. They're going to help people. Well, cigarettes is an addiction, my friend. It ain't that easy to quit. Proposition 57 reduces sentences for many nonviolent crimes and stops the practice of immediately sending juveniles to adult court. Vote yes if you want to stop children from being, you know, charged as adults. Children charged as adults. Vote yes. That's what Proposition 57 does. It stops that practice. Proposition 58 repeals part of Proposition 227 from 1994 to restore the option of bilingual education. Should we have bilingual education? We have people in this country that want to learn how to speak the language. Well, to tell you the truth, as a person that goes to all the local little stores, yes, we definitely want people to have bilingual education. So please, vote yes if you support bilingual education, Proposition 58. Proposition 59 is advisory, and I don't really understand that. But what it's advisory about, it requires officials to push to amend the U.S. Constitution to reverse the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling. Money is free speech, according to Citizens United. Actually, money subverts free speech. That's just ridiculous. Money is not speech. Corporations are not people. Vote yes for Proposition 59, but do not have the illusion that we can change manure into gold. I am not so sure that these bought and paid for politicians will immediately translate that into fighting for your rights, but it does make a political statement about where the people stand. It could be a first step towards mounting a legislative fight against Citizens United. Proposition 60 requires that actors in explicit sex scenes wear condoms on the job for health and safety. The Peace and Freedom Party recommends that you vote yes on that. I guess everybody that don't want a baby or a social disease probably ought to strap up a little bit. You know, let's move on. Proposition 61 places a limit on the amount of pharmaceutical companies that can charge the state for prescription drugs. Well, clearly, we have a need for that. Yes, we definitely want to put some regulation on how much these pharmaceutical firms can charge people. I saw a beautiful cartoon the other day. The pharmacist was standing behind the counter with his hands, one hand holding the medicine, and he says to the patient, he says, "Your money or your life." Because that's what it's come down to here in America. Okay, so please vote yes for Proposition 61. Proposition 62. Now, this requires some thought. Abolishes the death penalty. Now, we do not like the alternative presented in this proposition, which is life without the possibility of parole and other onerous provisions in this proposition. But we can and must end the death penalty, and we have a chance to end it now and counter the possibility of Proposition 66 taking precedence by getting more votes. So let me go straight to 66 and explain the relationship between Proposition 62 and Proposition 66. Proposition 66 would speed up the application of the death penalty and require inexperienced lawyers to take death penalty cases. I think we need to work to pass Proposition 62 and to vote yes on Proposition 62 and no on Proposition 66. These propositions are related. So if 66 passes, they will no longer give the death penalty, the person that is convicted of the death penalty, they may be innocent, they may be mitigating circumstances. They may have had bad counsel. Who knows? You know, anything could have happened. So what really happens today is this. They put so much money, so little money, I'm sorry, into the appeals process for prisoners that by the time you get the attorney of your choice, 10 years can go by. The advocates of death penalty focus, I think, made a fundamental mistake by saying we should do away with the death penalty because it costs too much. Well, it's true. The death penalty does cost too much. But what is the alternative if you place it on that level? Let's not make it cost so much. Let's speed it up. Let's force the prisoners to take any legal counsel that the state appoints to them. This would be a bad thing. There are over 700 people on death row right now in this state. The man on the top of the list, Kevin Cooper, is an innocent man on death row, provably innocent. So I tend to think, given the choice between the two, Proposition 62, which bans the death penalty with all these other provisions that we don't care for, and Proposition 66, which speeds up the death penalty. If you're opposed to the death penalty, I believe that what we have to do is support Proposition 62 and work to make a fairer dispensation for those prisoners who have, you know, been convicted of the death penalty and then would be receiving life without the possibility of parole. I still think people, if you know, should be able to appeal, for instance, their death penalty if they know that they're innocent, for instance. That happens. Okay, so much for the death penalty. Vote yes, Proposition 62, and no, Proposition 66. They are connected in that way. I hope I explained it properly. Proposition 63 requires retailers to promote anyone who purchases any ammunition to report anyone who purchases any ammunition to the Department of Justice. This is already a law prohibiting, there is already a law prohibiting the possession of large capacity magazine firearms. So now they want the people that sell, let's say you want to go hunting or you want to go practice so you can, you know how to use the weapon that you own. Well, come on now. That's constitutionally protected activity. Do we want the feds investigating everybody that buys ammunition? No, I don't think so. Vote no on Proposition 63. Proposition 64 legalizes marijuana. You got to legalize the marijuana. I'm serious. So, listen. Proposition 66. You tell all your friends, your family, everybody to hurry up and vote yes on Proposition 66. It legalizes marijuana and hemp in the state of California. It exempts medical marijuana from taxation and authorizes resentencing and destruction of records for prior marijuana convictions. Let me say that one more time so y'all, I want y'all to hear this. Proposition 64 legalizes marijuana and hemp. Right there, I'm voting yay. You don't have to smoke and hide. You don't have to jump no fence. You understand what I'm saying? You don't have to get all tense. You just roll your little stuff, sit down, and relax like you're supposed to. Well, not only that, does it legalize marijuana, it exempts medical marijuana from some taxation and authorizes resentencing and destruction of records for prior marijuana convictions. So especially anybody that knows anybody who's ever gone to jail for marijuana, please vote yes. This is why you got to vote on these propositions. No, I do not support the system. The system is broken. But if they ask you, can we continue to harass you and lock you up and dog you for smoking some chalawa? Hell no. Well, then vote yes. Vote for the legalization of marijuana. Proposition 64. Proposition 65 sounds like an environmental measure, but is designed to reduce support for a plastic bag ban. The Peace and Freedom Party is recommending that you vote no on that one. Proposition 66, I already described. Proposition 67 is a referendum on the plastic bag ban that was passed by the legislature to protect wildlife and prevent waste. The Peace and Freedom Party is recommending that you vote yes on Proposition 67. Let me ask you a question. Eric, are you aware that there's an area in the Pacific Ocean because to discard garbage, some people just take it and put it on a barge, take it out to the middle of the ocean, and they push it off the barge. So that now the plastic bags have kind of come together and stuck together, and they got a plastic bag island in the Pacific. Have you heard about this at all?
Yeah, I've heard about that. It's and it isn't just from like ocean dumping. It's from water pollution. It's from like uncontained landfills, and it's the size of, I've heard different things. It's the size of Texas, or it's the size of the continental U.S. But it is huge, right? It's this huge.
The size of Texas.
It's big. It's real big. Yeah, it is a gigantic island. And this is like currents sweep plastic into this space, and the currents collide in a certain way that lots and lots of plastic garbage ends up in the same spot in the ocean. Are we good on the propositions?
No.
Not just yet? Well, something that maybe I'll interject from my own perspective and my own heart about the nature of the ballot, and I think when folks go to the polls in November, I think what I have to say about that from my own place is it's important to acknowledge and realize that is not the be all end all of our political engagement with the world. Like, we are, we may be voters, but we are not only voters. And whether or not we're voters, we're political animals. We're political people. And so it's important not to, I think that what happens a lot of times is we go to the polls, we vote our conscience, and then we wash our hands. And my little soapbox thing to say about that before I give it back to Gerald is that we got to realize that, you know, political action doesn't stop there. Are we going to vote capitalism out of power? Are we going to vote prisons away? Maybe not. We have to be thinking beyond the ballot, right? Not to minimize the importance of these propositions, especially voting yes on 62, voting no on 66. These are ballot initiatives that have material consequences for people, and they're important. And one way or another, like what way those propositions go is going to affect hundreds and hundreds of people in this state. So I don't want to minimize that, but I also want folks to think about their political engagement with the world beyond voting.
You know what? Here is one of the reasons that it's questionable whether you want to support Measure E, because they're going to support charter schools. Charter schools have problems, and some people I'm opposed to them. Eric, why don't you share that with the people?
All right, so I have in front of me now a call to defend public education. There has been a lot of reporting recently about the problems that arise from charter school education, and so I'll just read this particular report. Over the past 23 years, we have witnessed the charter school industry systematically dismantling our public education system. It usually goes something like this. Public school is in predominantly low-income areas, closed due to false claims of low enrollment or false claims of failure. The public schools reopen as charter schools. The charter schools appoint private school boards that are unaccountable to taxpayers. Inexperienced or unlicensed teachers are often hired. Unfair application processes reject students with special needs. Students who are English language learners or students with low test scores. Schools in low-income areas get inexperienced or unlicensed teachers. Schools in high-income areas get highly qualified teachers with a student body that has few students with special needs or students who are not good test takers, and certainly no English language learners. The charter schools cherry pickers then have the gall to claim that these are good charter schools. These are not good charters. This is segregation. This is gentrification. True public schools cannot reject any student. All are accepted regardless of background.
See, so that's one of the reasons that that some people oppose that Measure E. You know? E1, which renews the Berkeley school bond. Okay? Because they talk about building charter schools. We're trying to do away with charter schools.
I'd like to spend a little bit more time later in the program talking more about what's happening in Merced, because we talk a lot about the nationwide prison strike, but what's happening in Merced is in our own backyard. It's very close to here, and it is at an increasingly critical point. There's an organization that I think you all should check out. They have a Facebook page. They're posting updates about the conditions of the hunger strikers as they resume their strike tomorrow. And they're actively involved in organizing. And the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee's chapter here in Oakland is actively looking for ways to provide them more and more material support and emotional support. And to that end, we are hosting a barbecue at Mosswood Park next Saturday. So that's Saturday the 8th from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. It's a potluck-style gathering. Bring your friends, bring as many folks as you can. We will be passing the hat for Live Free Merced to help keep money on these folks' commissaries, especially for phone calls. Corporations have privatized the phone systems in many, many institutions, and so it's very hard to keep lines of communication open. This will also be a chance to connect with other folks that are interested in prisoner solidarity and in doing this kind of support work. And in like possibly visiting and helping in that way. So that's at Mosswood Park next Saturday, 1 p.m. All right, y'all. One more event to plug, and then I'll talk a little bit about Petey Perez. But we are Ghost Town Prisoner Support is hosting a letter writing night this Thursday. Now, we do this every couple of weeks, but this particular Thursday, October 6th, is going to be particularly special because we're working in collaboration with the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee to help strengthen their in-reach program. They're gonna come with a lot of things to teach us about writing to prisoners, about writing to political prisoners, about helping to organize with, build relationships with political folks who are incarcerated. We may also be showing a film and doing some call-in work, calling into various facilities and asking them to meet hunger strikers' demands or to stop engaging in particular forms of repression that we know about. This kind of organizing is very important for getting support to the prisoners and getting information out of the prisons. So that is on Thursday night, October 6th at 7:30 p.m. in West Oakland. For more information on that, you can go to Ghost Town Prisoner Support on Facebook, like us, and we'll have an event page as well. Or for more information, you can email Ghost Town Prisoner Support at list.riseup.net. And so, getting to the Petey Perez case. So, on September 14th, 2014, Richmond police officer Wallace Jensen shot Richard Petey Perez III to death outside Uncle Sam's Liquor on Cutting Boulevard. Officials, after a very questionable investigation, said that Petey had attacked the officer and tried to take his gun, but witnesses say that's not what they told the police. And citizens investigators from the Oscar Grant Committee have recorded their statements and gotten a copy of the store's surveillance video. None of the evidence supports the official story. To their credit, several news media reported witnesses disputing this story within days. Richmond Confidential reported that Mohamed Delik, the store clerk, said he did not see Perez reach for the officer's gun. The San Jose Mercury News wrote that John Burris, representing Petey's family in a civil suit against the city, said that he had witnesses who dispute that Petey was reaching for Jensen's gun. Richmond Police Chief Chris Magnus said that at least one independent witness confirmed their story, but we've never seen this witness. So there is a call to action, state of emergency call to action, being given by the Justice for Mario Woods Coalition to demand that these police murderers be charged, to demand independent investigations into the murder of Mario Woods, the murder of Jessica Nelson, the murder of Louis Gongora, and the murder of Alex Nieto. These are the officers that are guilty. These are the officers who have been part of these murders. Winston Seto, Anito Santos, Charles August, Nicholas Cuevas, Scott Phillips, Justin Erb, Nate Sager, Michael Malone, Jason Sawyer, Roger Morse, Richard Schiff, Nathan Chu. These are the cops who have been murdering people in our city and in our area. This event... So, the call to action is for a rally on Friday, October 7th at 12 p.m. at 850 Bryant Street in San Francisco. So, it's a busy weekend, folks. Just to recap, Ghost Town Prisoner Support Letter Writing Night in collaboration with the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, Thursday night at 7:30 p.m. Like us on Facebook, email Ghost Town Prisoner Support at list.riseup.net for the address and for more information on the night. If call to action for a rally on October 7th at 12 p.m. at 850 Bryant Street in San Francisco. And on Saturday, the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee barbecue to help support Merced prison strikers at 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. at Mosswood Park.
Yeah, just to clarify, give you a sense of what Slave Revolt, you know, actually thinks of what we call capitalist politicians, whom, in fact, Hillary Clinton would be a quintessential example. I'm going to share with you what I consider some paranoid type of propaganda, but you know what? This apparently happened. It may be a coincidence, but people think that Hillary Clinton is somehow responsible for this. These are friends and acquaintances of the Clintons who died unexpectedly in the last 2 months. John Ash, president of UN body until 2013, unlike Ban Ki-moon, who was head spokesperson, had corrupt dealings with Chinese businessmen involving millions in real estate deals. Hillary was also involved, as was the Clinton Foundation. John lost his presidential post due to this corruption. He was scheduled to speak to the FBI about Hillary's involvement, but the day before that, he was found dead in his home with a barbell having crushed his windpipe. Possibly a coincidence? Possibly not. Guccifer One is a Romanian who had hacked Hillary's non-encrypted server. He was arrested and jailed in Virginia, found dead, hung by a rope in his cell, the day before he was scheduled to speak to the FBI about Hillary's server. Seth Rich, top aide to the Democratic National Council tasked with making it easier for people to find their polling places throughout the U.S., had information on voting fraud, was to speak to the FBI, but at 4 a.m. he was attacked and shot twice in the back and the back of his head and beaten and bruised throughout his body before his meeting with the FBI. It was called a robbery gone wrong, but no wallet, credit cards, money, or his watch was taken. Video online of Hillary, so sad over the death of her friend, Seth, with Bernie beside her, looking both sad and scared. Used by Hillary as a political incident to push gun control. Some think it was a message. Joe Montano, a Filipino-American aide to Senator Kaine, now Hillary's vice presidential candidate, died the first day of the DNC convention, suspected of knowing too much. Who knows? Sean Lucas, August 2nd video of him serving the DNC and Debbie Schultz with a class action suit about election fraud. He died in his bathroom floor in his home. Victor Thorne, August 1st, a writer who wrote about the Clintons, reveled in following their controversies and writing about them, was found dead on a mountainside. Vincent Fleck, father of Hillary's physician, Dr. Daniel Fleck, was found dead, shot execution style, near his home just 24 hours after releasing Hillary's most secret medical records to the public. Info was immediately erased. Well, I tell you what, sort of interesting, but in fact, what's wrong with Hillary is not simply that she may indeed be a gangster-type murderer, but is her program of support to capitalism and her long list of corporate supporters and contributors. I think that's far more important. And just to give you a sense of what we think, I did not support Obama. I never support Democrats. And here is a song about Mr. Obama that, well, I hope you enjoy.
You can say you are a man of the people, and you have our interests in mind. You can say you stand with the working class, and you would march on our picket lines. You can say you're with the underdogs, not the billionaires on Wall Street. And you look so earnest as you shake the hands of all the good people you meet, but you don't fool me. No, you don't fool me. You can call yourself a man of action. You can say we've got to make haste. You can talk so convincingly about all the hazards we face. You can blather on about green jobs with nukes and natural gas. You can reminisce about your youth and the time that you smoked some grass. But you don't fool me. No, you don't fool me. You can say you are a man of peace. You can talk like you know the score. Yeah, if you were in the Senate at the time, you would have voted against the war. You can say that every drone strikes a blow for liberty. You can claim this is not an empire. You just want everyone to be free. But you don't fool me.
No.
No, you don't fool me. You can make a speech about hope and change. You can bring us all to tears. You can list all your accomplishments. Say, give us four more years. You can make the case your party is so different from the other. You can say you've got my back. You can call yourself my brother. But you don't fool me. No, you don't fool me. You don't fool me.
Oh.
No, you don't fool me.
Okay, so there you have it. Now you know I can't fool you, because he can't fool me. Goodbye, Mr. Obama. And in fact, this is a general song I'm going to play now That explains how I feel about the Democrats, and I'm glad that Mr. Rovix made this song. It's called, well, you'll hear what it's called.
Wilson said he was an isolationist, and he would not send our young men off to die. But as soon as he won the race for president, that turned out to be just another lie. Truman said he wouldn't kill civilians, and he didn't want to hurt nobody's mom. But as soon as he had the opportunity, he went and dropped the atom bomb. Kennedy, he said he was a man of peace, but with the battle flag unfurled, he sent the U.S. Navy to the Cuban shore, and then he just about blew up the world. Democrats make me wanna vomit. Liberals make me wanna hack. They love to talk like they are friends of you and me, and then every time they stab us in the back, every time they stab us in the back. Then there is that guy we know as LBJ. He was the one for Great Society. He sent his Air Force down to blow up Vietnam to make sure that those folks were good and free. Jimmy was the one who talked of human rights. Human rights for everybody, ha ha ha. He was opposed to dictatorships and torture. That's why he loved Suharto and the Shah. Democrats make me wanna vomit. Liberals make me wanna hack. They love to talk like they are friends of you and me, and then every time they stab us in the back, every time they stab us in the back. Bill was from a little town in Arkansas. He was just another Joe. That's why when all the people said don't do it, he went and signed the WTO. Some people, they might think I'm cynical, and I don't know why that would be. So even though they voted for the war, now I'm going for Barack and Hillary. Democrats make me wanna vomit. Liberals make me wanna hack. They love to talk like they are friends of you and me, and then every time they stab us in the back. Democrats make me wanna vomit. Liberals make me wanna hack. They love to talk like they are friends of you and me, and then every time they stab us in the back, every time they stab us in the back.
Well, there you have it. They make me wanna vomit. You're listening to Slave Revolt Radio here at Berkeley Liberation Radio, 104.1 on your FM dial. I just want to mention that today, actually Sunday, there will be October 2nd, there's going to be a series of forums sponsored by the group Speak Out Now. It's called the Revolutionary University Tools for Changing Society. So today, it's called at 1:30 to 3:30 Crisis. It's How Capitalism Works, and it's Richard D. Wolf will be at the Neville Proctor Library, located 6501 Telegraph Avenue, in Oakland. And then that will be followed at 4 o'clock by another forum called Our Role in Transforming the World. Activists in Speak Out Now will present a revolutionary socialist perspective on the challenges and choices we are confronted with today. Now I want to talk about the fight for health care in America. And just tell you, when Mumia Abdul-Jamal got seriously ill with hepatitis C, I know a little bit about diabetes because I've had family and friends who have been stricken by this deadly disease. His blood sugar was over 700. I don't care what anybody says. I know that that is a dangerous level to have your blood sugar. The brother almost died. The Labor Action Committee to Free Mumia sprung into action as best we could, and we began to build. We didn't want to just leave it with Mumia, because he is not the only person on the planet that has hepatitis C, nor is he the only person in the prisons with that deadly disease. So we formed a coalition of community advocates to protest hepatitis C profiteering by Gilead Sciences Incorporated. This started off by us going to J.P. Morgan's 34th Annual Healthcare Conference. So what was that conference? That conference took place on January the 11th of this year, and it was a place where investors could come and hear presentations by various pharmaceutical corporations and decide where to make their their investments so they can make profit, okay? We picketed this gathering. It was located at St. Francis Hotel, located on Powell Street in San Francisco. So, you know, Gilead Sciences Incorporated is a leading developer of hepatitis C medications. Actually, they're not developers of anything. They bought the patent from someone else and then jacked up the damn prices. This condition affects about 5 million persons in the United States and 170 million persons worldwide. An 18-month investigation by the Senate Finance Committee under the leadership of ranking member Ron Wyden and Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican from Idaho, revealed that Gilead's so-called pricing and marketing strategy was designed to maximize revenue with little concern for the access or affordability of the drug. And they concluded that, now these are bourgeois politicians, these are capitalist politicians, they concluded that Gilead pursued a calculated scheme for pricing and marketing its hepatitis C drug based on one primary goal: maximizing their profit, regardless of the human consequences. The cost to America's health system has been staggering, and recent restrictions in Gilead's patient assistance program has left thousands of persons without access to this life-saving medication. And you know what? Man, I tell you, it's just really, really unfortunate. A coalition of hepatitis C community, along with the Labor Action Committee and others concerned with this, we had the California nurses supported us, doctors, different pharmacists. I was shocked at how many people stepped forward. And we're out there picketing these son of a guns. And so at this protest, just to tell you a little interesting story, a reporter came downstairs to kind of see she was covering what was going on inside. But they could hear our chants. And our chants were very, very simple and to the point. Public health, not corporate wealth. Immediate and free treatment for all HCV infected prisoners. no execution by medical neglect. Jail, drug, profiteers, free mumia. Those were our slogans. That was a brief report of that incident. Now I'm coming back to Eric.
All right, hey y'all. I wanted to thank everybody for joining us today. I wanted to run through our event announcements one last time. Ghost Town Prisoner Support is hosting a letter writing night. This is your chance to get involved with the ongoing prisoner strike and to support the hunger strikers in Merced. Also, the Mario Woods Coalition call for a rally at noon on Friday. That's at 850 Bryant Street. And finally, the iWalk Barbecue for Live Free Merced on Saturday, October 8th at 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. If you want more information on any of those events, check out Ghost Town Prisoner Support on Facebook and or send an email to ghosttownprisonersupport@list.riseup.net. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, so that's going to be it for us right now here at Slave Revolt Radio. I'll say again, thank you for listening. And please tell your friends, your classmates, your co-workers about our broadcast. It takes place every Sunday, 12 to 2, here at Berkeley Liberation Radio, 104.1 on your FM dial. Thank you very much for listening.